accession number 33202, reel 6.
Terry Light, reel 6.
So, in my memory now, it was completely changed. I had to sleep in the I section where all the maps were kept, so that being the junior NCO, I had a couple of stripes by now, being the junior NCO and Sergeant Sparvel being what he was, used to leave me to get on with it, so that anybody who came in the I section where all this so-called secret documentation was, you had to be signed, you know, there was a strict sign-in, sign-out procedure.
And were you aware of what the secret was?
No, I didn't know. Well, I knew that it was going to be somewhere. And putting two and two together, you know, you got the news that there were these problems in Israel, was girding up the war machine again. Eden and the French Premier's name, I've forgotten. They were getting their heads together. Certainly in October, there was all the political kerfuffle. Eden wanting to, with his French counterpart, wanting to go to interfere, go to war. These damned Egyptians who dared to nationalise the canal. The M6 or the M5 or the M4 for British trade to the Far East, and the jewel and the crown, as was. So all things were, you know, churning up very rapidly and changing within the little bubble of three para, where we were confined to camp or barracks, as you might call it, and really killing time, waiting to see what would happen. The only other thing I remember at that particular time was that censorship was brought in, and Sparvel and I had the unenviable task of reading letters from personnel in headquarter company and then sealing them up and sending them on their way if we could see any notes, messages, sentences, phrases which somebody was letting out a so-called military secret, then it had to be cut out or blacked out.
What sort of things were you looking for?
Anything of a military flavour which could, somebody was guessing as to what was going to happen with Three Para, which would then go on to England to their sister, brother, girlfriend, wife or whatever it is, and let the cat out of the bag. That was the only thing. Censorship. It was a form of censorship. And of course, we were only allowed to do other ranks. Burke would have done officers. And then once you'd read the letters, seal them up and send them on their way.
And did people know that that was going on?
So they must have. Oh. Must have known. Because they would be collected at various company headquarters and then brought into us for this censorship. This personal dig, poke into people's letters. One of these things, I suppose. So, right, we're building up to really the 5th of November. As I remember again, Operation Telescope, I think it was called, code name. It had to be postponed again and again. One, because the RAF didn't have enough, or Transport Command RAF didn't have enough transport planes. And another thing was they had to assemble the fleet sailing from Malta. Consisting of 45 and 42 Royal Marines. All I did know at this stage was three para were going in on a parachute drop, an airborne landing. Beyond that, I'm not sure when I would have found out that there was going to be a seaborne landing, but as it turned out, I think the seaborne landing was supposed to take place at the same time as the airborne landing, but as it turned out, the seaborne landing came in 24 hours later. So we girded up our loins and, you know, did the necessary, wrote the last letters, packed our kit. We would be told what to put in our personal weapons containers.
Can you remember what you took?
Sten gun. Remember my experiences with the Sten gun? Sten gun, maps, aerial photographs, and my own personal belongings, including a couple of cameras. So it was a fairly lightweight personal container compared to some of my colleagues who were, as I've indicated earlier on, some of them who were in, say, anti-tank or parts of headquarter company signals, for example. They would be loaded up in dire straits. And really, the atmosphere was such that each of the companies, SALT companies, headquarters, support, all went into their own little igloos and did their own thing, got ready. They'd been issued with the necessary instructions. I'm not sure that they would have been told what was virtually happening, because I don't think any of us were really told until the day before, en masse. And then there was the usual gathering together, padres, prayers. And then you were told to, you know, get any sleep if you can. And then, this is, I remembered, had been after some delays, postponements, because of problems with RAF transport. Poor old RAF transport, they were always struggling. They still struggle these days, not having enough planes for the job in hand. And then we enplaned at Nicosia Airport in the early hours of the 5th of November. I was in Hastings. I don't know which Hastings aircraft I was. There were 32 transporters used. I don't know which one, but I do know I was in the port stick number 13. And then we emplaned, this fleet of Hastings, four-engined, Valettas, two-engined, made their way from Cyprus by a zigzag route towards El Gamo Airfield, Port Said. All I can remember that flight is, because most of us tried to get some sleep or kept quiet and kept our feelings to ourselves, was that I managed to look out one of the windows, and below we were flying over very low over a fleet of ships, and I didn't know it at the time, but that fleet of ships which we flew over was the American 6th Fleet. And of course, as history has disclosed, the American 6th Fleet were shadowing all the aerial and all the all forts of throughout the communications which were going on between Cyprus and the aerial armada and the seaborne armada. As it happened, they were out to sea shadowing the actual landings, much to, as an afterthought, much to my annoyance. There you are, what America did. The special so-called, what do they call it, between the United Kingdom and the United States, the...
Special relationship.
There's no special relationship, in my opinion. The only relationship between those two countries is that when it suits the United States of America. But I digress. I could go on a long time about that. So it was a zigzag flight to Port Said. We came in from west to east. Everything goes into automatic, I suppose. I went out the plane as usual. Everything went according to plan. chute opened all right, no twisted lines. Mediterranean Sea to the left, the salt marshes to the right, and the DZ airfield, two runways as I remember it, of El Gamal, down below. One thing that I was privy to, I suppose, all of us in the I section was privy to, was that some of the last aerial photographs to come down from Brigade to us, and the aerial photographs were taken by Canberra reconnaissance aircraft going up from Nicosia Airport, when the last one showed all these dots and the tracks of vehicles across the sand of El Gamal Airport, airfield. And there was a thought that these were the tracks of somebody laying mines on the DZ landing strip. But as it turned out, it wasn't mines, it was oil barrel drums, which had been sensibly placed out by the Egyptian army to prevent any aircraft landing on the runways. So there was that, I seem to remember there was a little flurry of, God, what the hell are we jumping into at one stage during the 24 hours leading up to actually going. So we landed.
Can you remember the jump?
Pardon?
Can you remember the jump?
I can remember it only in the sense that it was normal. No hiccups. And all I can remember really is that from time of going exit to the time of landing seemed to be a very short time, because I'd barely released my weapons container before I hit the terra firma. Now, I understand since then that the RAF always tell you the mandatory lowest height they'll drop you out at is 800 feet. Now, I understand that we went out at somewhere between 600, maybe 550 feet. They wanted to get rid of us in a hurry, which I can understand to a certain extent. So the point that I'm really making is the time between exiting and landing, we had very little time in which to do the necessary checks and also get rid of that damn weapons container.
If you landed without having got rid of the weapons container, what could that do?
Well, I would think if you had a weapons container containing equipment, base plate, say, of a mortar or other hardware, you would break your leg at least. I think I would have been all right, because all my material except for my personal weapon was software. So I don't think I would have had any problems, but I still wouldn't like to, because you lose your flexibility with that strapped to your leg. It's difficult to bend your leg for a start. So I tried to think what might have happened.
So you landed?
Yeah, as a reflection back, and we've talked about this, some of us ran a cup of tea and ran a jar of ale. You know, you all have your own private fears. And I suppose at that time I had two private fears uppermost in my mind. One, that the aircraft would be shot down or would come down through mechanical problems and I'd be trapped in the aircraft. And the other one would be that I would jump out okay, but I would drift and land either in the salt marshes to the right or into the Mediterranean on the left. Now, I'd never, although some people have done this, I'd never done a water landing. And so, I mean, say the procedure is, if I understand, if you do a water landing in sea, is obviously get rid of your weapons container for a start straight away, otherwise that's going to drag you under. You've still got a chute above you, you've still got a spare one on your chest, which is going to drag you down. So get rid of all those as quickly as possible. That's easier said than done, in my opinion. Okay, you can punch your centre plate here and release all your straps, but when you're hitting water and all the movement of the water, I dread to think what would happen. But it didn't happen in any case. So that was my two main fears. Other people would have had different fears. Being seen airsick, and I suppose being shot at or shot while floating down to terra firma. You know, you everybody has his own thoughts on that. So I landed, I suppose, quicker than I expected in El Gamal airfield. My rendezvous was the airport control tower. So really it was a case of getting out what I had to, or getting rid of my chute, bundling it up, leaving it where it was. That would be for the clearance party to get rid of. Getting the stuff I wanted out of my weapons container, making sure I had a slot in my stun gun if necessary, and then, like everybody else, calmly trotting off in organised fashion or disorganised fashion to their relative RVs.
And can you just sketch the airfield for me, sort of just give me a mental map of the layout of the land?
I'll give you a real map if you want to.
Well, talk me through.
Well, you land. I've seen it from aerial photographs. I've seen it direct from above. I've seen it at an angle. And I would have had, therefore, the advantage over many of my colleagues being able to see these things before they actually experienced it. Aerial photographs shot from, say, a camera directly above, X thousand feet above. You've got two runways, control tower on the seaward side, Mediterranean side. Beyond the control tower, coastal road, track, the sea. To the south, the Mazala, lakes, salt marshes. Southeast, sewage farm, for port side. And then behind you, west, where we came from, would have been going back towards the Nile Delta, which, as far as I was concerned, was just tracks, very little habitation. Looking east would be the typical, what shall I call it, facilities of a town, city. Like Port Said, Port Fouad, which was on the other side, I think had a population of about 200,000. So on our side, Port Said, you would have the cemetery. And then flats, high-rise flats. And then you would start to come into the shanty town. And then from the shanty town, you would move into what I would call a modern town or city, leading to the port itself, which is the port of Port Said, being divided from Port Fouad, where the French landed, by the northern end of the Suez Canal. So that's the aerial view. Once you're on the ground at El Gamal, well, okay, over there would be the control tower to the airport. Flat, as far as I'm concerned, to the south and to the east. As far as I'm concerned, any trouble was going to come from that way, where the Egyptian army or the Fedayeen.
From the cemetery.
And the cemeteries, yeah. And maybe the flats beyond them. That was where the trouble could be. All I remember when I was trotting from the where I dropped and got rid of my chutes would be that there was the sound of small arms fire, popping a small arms fire. Beyond that, I can't remember a great deal, because my focus target was to get into the what I thought might be the relative safety of the control tower and start to make myself useful by setting up the tactical headquarters, mapping. And the maps. Tactical headquarters would have been manned, or the people I remember around there would have been obviously the CO at first, certainly the 2IC, Beckett, the adjutant, RSM, the company sergeant major of headquarter company, regimental police, ourselves in the I section, and regimental signallers. And they really occupied the control. We were on the ground floor. The control tower itself was relatively intact, but all the windows had been shot out. And but other than that, I can't remember any other major damage to it. So whether the RAF had tried to preserve it or in the pre-landings, or whether they just missed it, I've no idea at all. So really, we that first day, we there was a lot of coming and going. In other words, there were a few further landings after us. D Company, as an assault company, didn't come in until, as I remember it, late in the morning or mid-morning. Whereas, damn it all, they should have been in amongst the first three assault companies. Why that happened, I don't know. You better ask somebody in Dog Company. I don't know. But anyway, we set ourselves up and went through the usual routine, which, where I suppose training and military discipline snaps into action.
So talk me through the usual routine in that circumstance.
Well, setting up the tactical map and ensuring that it's capable of accepting all the incoming wireless messages of company movements, platoon movements where appropriate, section movements, which the company commanders would send in to Sunray, Sunray being the commanding officer. Somebody's pointed out to you that the commanding officer has now died. He's now dead. The 2IC, Colonel Beckett, he's still alive, I think, living in the United States. So the most senior commissioned officer you're going to have access to will be Mike Walsh, who was a major then. He was in, so the various company commanders would be obviously leading their companies into action on the allocated field of fire. After a while, the CO left us to be up front. In other words, a parachute commander believes in leading from the front, so he would be somewhere with Major Stevens or Major Walsh or Major Norman, as the case may be, up front. And in charge, really, the senior officer in charge of headquarters in the control tower would be Lieutenant Colonel Beckett, 2IC. And so really, we did as we were told, got on with what we were supposed to do. Somewhere around mid-morning, or perhaps earlier, somebody started flinging over mortars from the opposition and making a nuisance of themselves. Mortar fire, I suppose the biggest problem with mortar fire, as far as I'm aware, is the shrapnel. And with it, the effect of flying glass and other bits of concrete. The only thing I can remember is some flying glass, as I assume it was, cut my upper lip there and made it bleed. And somebody came up to me from the... of course, there would be the medical officer and his medics in the headquarters company at that time, although before they went out to attend to any injuries, asking me if I was all right, and I said yes, you know, wiping a smudge of blood away. The family joke is that if you can see a slight scar on my upper lip, that was caused by an anti-tank shell, but that's just a family joke. There was nothing of consequence other than going through the day and hearing what was going on, having a first-hand running commentary by listening to what was being fed back from the companies.
So tell me what you remember of what was going on.
Oh, I can remember there would be a lot of shouting out there. And the shouting would also include a lot of effing and blinding. And you would hear certainly the company commanders talking to one another. And then there'd be perhaps a breakdown in communication. I don't know whether that would be because that particular signaler failed to twiddle the right knobs, or whether it would be because of interference from some obstacle. Remember, in those days, there was none of this mobile phone nonsense. Signals, permanent signals, had to reel out a line, a landline. Odious task. And of course, they'd reel out their landline to where company commander B or whatever it was had set himself up, and then get it all fixed up for communication, and then he'd move on, have to move on. So they'd have to reel it all back in again, start all over again. It was war at that particular time. So it was none of this instant communication which you have today over mobile phones, or the equivalent of mobile phones. What do they call them? Bow, I think the latest communication equipment is called the bowhead. But that's out of my range now. So I suppose, I know the other thing that reminds me is that we first became apparent that were identified as tanks. The alarm bells went up, get the anti-tank guns out here, wherever it happened to be, as quickly as possible, because we spotted some tanks in such and such a part of, and then they'd give the grid reference. And you'd plot it on the map, that grid reference. As it turned out, they weren't tanks, they were self-propelled guns. In other words, you know what a self-propelled gun is? It's a tracked vehicle, but with a fixed heavy gun on the front, whereas a tank has a turret, which will swivel. Now, a self-propelled gun, what the Egyptians had, they were either built by the Czechoslovakians or built by the Russians. If it had to alter its line of fire, it had to move its tracks, and the whole contraption would have to move to fire that way, whereas a normal tank would just swivel the turret and bang. But we had were anti-tank guns, 105mm anti-tank guns, mounted on jeeps, mounted on jeeps, stripped-down jeeps, which had been dropped in. Although one didn't survive, it buried itself in the sand, in the ground, to counteract that threat. Now, that, if that had ever developed into a serious threat, but it didn't, and I'll tell you why in a minute, then we could have been in big trouble because we were lightly armed. I'm gonna stop.